Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is David Gutterson, whose latest novel is The Other. Earlier novels, Our Lady of the Forest, East of the Mountains, and Snow Falling on Cedars, collection of short stories, a book about homeschooling from 1992, which I do want to talk to you about. Before we went on the air, you were talking about how Our Lady of the Forest and The Other take you in a somewhat different direction than the earlier novels. Why do you think that is?
I think those earlier novels suggest a view of life that's somewhat more black and white than in the latter novels, where the world is more muddled, the characters are more flawed, things are less certain, there's just generally more ambiguity about life.
How do you think this reflects upon your own views of ambiguity in life?
I just think it's inevitable as you get older that you change. Your view of life, your view of yourself, view of the world is transformed just by definition as you get older, and inevitably that's going to be reflected in your work, and it's reflected in my work. I think the earlier books are probably more earnest. They're more insistent in the moral sense. The latter books are more interested in the real dirt of human life.
The Other deals with friendship between two people, John William Barry and Neil Countryman. Barry is a wealthy guy who goes off into the woods, Neil Countryman, and is his friend. People have compared this book to Into the Wild, which makes me wonder, is there any relationship?
There has to be, because both books take a look at somebody who renounces conventional life, leaves society behind, and makes the effort to live outside of civilization. There's a pronounced difference, though, between the two books. Chris McCandless, the protagonist, I guess you would say, of John Krakauer's nonfiction book, Into the Wild, is very much in this tradition of the romantic view of retreat or of leaving the world behind. He has wanderlust. What he wants to do is dispense with all the conventions of middle-class life, and he takes a certain joy. He finds joy in nature. He finds joy in travel. He feels liberated from social conventions, and that drives him. John William comes from a very different tradition, not the romantic tradition. The romantic tradition might be something we see, for example, in Kerouac. In The Other, my character, John William, would be more in the tradition of those renunciates that you might see who are driven by religious faith. The hermits of Christianity, the monks who go on retreat who are Buddhist, that impulse to leave the world behind that is not so much about seeking joy in a romantic view of life, but are more about the contemplative possibilities of an isolated existence.
Then in that sense, there's a direct connection between The Other and Our Lady of the Forest, which deals with faith as well.
Yeah, both of these books look at aspects of faith. You know, in Our Lady of the Forest, it's the idea of revelation. In this book, it's the idea of renunciation. And both of those are clearly spiritual concepts, and they're of interest to me.
When you were beginning The Other, how conscious were you of Into the Wild?
I had read the book. I was aware of it, but I was also aware of many other books that in one way or another related to what I was doing. There's Robinson Crusoe, who doesn't choose it, but nevertheless must deal with isolation. There are a lot of these sort of books that might fit into the category of the young adult novel, that you end up reading when you're a young adult. And that fantasy of living by yourself in the woods is one that there is a history and tradition.
And you knew that it could be compared to that and that you'd have to deal with that.
I just didn't have any concern for that. I felt that what I was doing was so different. I mean, really, when you look at the story of Into the Wild, it's primarily the story of somebody who has wanderlust and who moves from situation to situation and affects people's lives, and who brings with him this romanticism wherever he goes. It's only at the end of that story that for 100 days he attempts to live in a bus in Alaska. That's a different story from someone who decides to be a hermit for many, many years.
You once said, "I can't blame any human from staring into the abyss and coming away despondent." And I guess John William fits that category.
That's a good description of modern nihilism. The person who feels that there is no meaning to life, there's no possibility of the transcendent. We're just briefly here and then we briefly disappear and everything is meaningless and there's no point to doing anything because nothing matters. And John William doesn't quite fit into that nihilistic view of things because he's very devoted to Gnosticism, which is this early Christian heretical tradition. In Gnosticism, there is something to live for. There is meaning. Because for the Gnostics, this world is an illusion. You're sleeping when you live in this world, and you have this potential to awaken and to confront the truth and to arrive at revelation. And that's certainly very, very different from nihilistic gloom.
How did you come into bringing Gnosticism into the story?
I started getting interested in Gnosticism immediately after the events of 9/11. I was in Washington, D.C. on a National Endowment for the Arts panel on 9/11 and ended up to get home back 3,000 miles across the country driving with another writer. And she taught classes in Gnosticism, was very knowledgeable. We had a lot of time to talk, of course, over the course of days. And she got me interested in the subject, and I started reading about it. In that sort of dark post 9/11 period, Gnosticism had a lot of cogency, and there was a lot to it that seemed to make sense at the time. I still think it has a lot to it. It's definitely worth looking at. I think people who dismiss it as just a dark form of heresy are not looking at the potential for truth and beauty in the Gnostic tradition.
Well, the Gnostic tradition postulates an evil God.
It does. What's important about that is you might think of it as the supreme God, the real, the absolute God, the God behind our minor deity, Jehovah, is what you want to get to. But we're stuck in a world that functions according to the needs and the pettiness and the flawed nature of a minor deity, Jehovah, off in his corner of the universe, toying with us. And so for the Gnostics, it's not as if they feel that God is evil, but they do feel that this sub-deity, Jehovah, is evil.
And that, of course, ties in with the idea that behind the illusion is the reality of Buddhism.
Yes. So for somebody like John William, who buys into this idea of Gnosticism, that you must renounce the world in the name of the salvation of your own soul. I mean, it's not just that he has a cultural critique of America, that he doesn't want to participate in a economic and political system that's grounded in the exploitation of other human beings. He certainly has that. But he also believes deeply that by participating in this world, in this flawed world, that there's no chance to penetrate to truth and therefore salvation.
What he calls the hamburger world.
Yeah, what he calls hamburger world, yes.
Where did that come from? Just out of your head? Or?
Yeah, just out of my head. I mean, you use the term hamburger, and I think you think of a hamburger, and it immediately elicits a lot of associations and has connotation that goes with it, and it speaks for itself.
David Gutterson, in the end, there's a long segment involving his parents trying to come to grips with why he became what he became. Why do you think John William became a hermit?
Well, I do believe for everybody there is an enormous sense of foundation to one's actions in life that accrues to childhood, that what happens to you in your childhood is really a big deal. I'm not saying anything very illuminating because there's a general agreement that what happens to you in your early years is incredibly influential. And so ultimately, John William goes to the woods because of the psychological and emotional conditions of his childhood. And those psychological and emotional conditions of family dynamic are what drive him to Gnosticism, are what drive him to be at odds with the world, put him in a position where he cannot really relate to other human beings. And ultimately, it's that drives him into the woods.
Was the final segment of the book, was that in the back of your mind throughout the entire book, or did that kind of emerge as the story emerged?
Well, the final segment of this book, in the strict linear sense, goes back in time to John William's childhood.
Right.
So as a writer, I had thought through his life chronologically, and I had invented or created these childhood conditions, and I was bringing that to bear as I was writing. I just made the decision that material was most effective dramatically at the end of the novel, but I had an awareness of it all the way through.
David Gutterson, the main character is not John William, but rather a character named Neil Countryman. Countryman is kind of an odd name.
Possibly a name that would strike people as heavy-handed in its symbolism. Countryman certainly speaks in a loud voice. And that's okay if people want to view it that way. I think it's a good, solid Irish name, which grounds my character in his Irish blue-collar roots. And it does have some value beyond that. I think it does suggest something about who he is.
Well, Neil Countryman, in many regards, is probably the closest thing we've come so far to David Gutterson.
I'd say in the strict sort of biographical facts of his life, there's no question about that. I mean, like me, born in Seattle, like me, graduated from public school in Seattle in 1974, went on to the University of Washington, became a high school English teacher, married, had children, and never really moved away from the area that he grew up in. So in all those particulars, very much like me. In his sensibility, his view of the world, his temperament, I think there's some affinity. I do feel a kind of kinship, but I also feel a kinship for John William. I think this book, these two characters, represent polar sides of an inner dialogue I have with myself. I think we all experience ourselves as the other. The other isn't necessarily somebody outside of you. It can be somebody inside of you. I identify as powerfully with John William, the hermit, as I do with the everyman, Neil.
Even though Neil has your taste probably in music, I would think, and some of your taste probably in books.
I have to say I drew heavily on myself in inventing even the particulars of Neil's life, even down to those kind of specific things that you're mentioning.
And the trip to Europe.
That's right. The trip to Europe that he takes immediately after high school is similar to something I did after high school.
Is that how you met your wife?
I did, but actually it wasn't a trip to Europe. It was a trip mostly to Asia. That's right. I met my wife as Neil meets his wife as a very young man. Same thing happened to me. This book, in many ways, has elements of my own biography in it.
Did that make it easier or harder to work with the character and his relationships?
I think it ultimately makes it harder. You know, in the prior three novels, I took seriously the adage that you should stay away from your personal material and set the story in another place and time, because you run the risk of indulging in a romantic way, in an over-emotional way, in a sentimental way, over-dramatizing the facts of your own existence. You have no objectivity. What happens to you might seem very, very profound. It might seem worthwhile for other people to know about, but in fact, it generally isn't. And you're much better off getting some distance and writing about other people for a while and gaining some experience and letting some time go by before you can approach your own life, the facts of your own life, without bringing that sentimentality and drama to it.
Well, I would think also the other problem is that in your own life, we all tend to editorialize about things, and that derives from our past. Neil Countryman could just as easily be talking about homeschooling as you. I mean, he doesn't, but let's say he could, or his politics could be the same as yours, and that creates an entirely new environment, which maybe you don't want to go into.
No, because in the end, the character and all the specific, you know, nuances of character are there in service to the novel. They're one organic aspect of the novel. And it's irrelevant whether the author, you know, has some feeling one way or the other about, say, homeschooling. And maybe that has no relevance to the book, and so you dispense with it.
Well, what I've noticed lately in talking to authors, and they're unapologetic, is after 8 years of the Bush administration, a lot of people are beginning to throw things in the book. And I say, you know, that's kind of self-indulgent in that while I might agree with your politics, you know, I wonder about inserting political material. And the response was, you know, I don't care.
I think there are a couple of important points with regard to that. Number one, a novel has no duty or obligation to take a position on any issue. That's not what a novel is about. I think novels are potentially about asking certain questions or creating a context for people to look at questions, but they're not about taking a position or having an answer. And I think books that do that pose really some kind of danger and read a little bit like propaganda. The other thing that I think is very important to remember is that you're not merely writing for this moment, and that the passions that have to do with today that are in the New York Times front page today will probably be, in many regards, irrelevant to people 5 years from now, 10 years from now, who will be reading your book. So you want to be careful about thinking in the long term, I think, about the life of your stories. I do think it's correct, though, to say that since 9/11, that all novels are in some way 9/11 novels by virtue of the fact that they're written in the aftermath of it. The author has an awareness of it. The author knows that this book is going to appear in the post-9/11 environment, and the reader reads it with a post-9/11 consciousness. It's not 9/11. It's what 9/11 has generated. It's the political implications of 9/11 that are graver concerns in the society generally, and also of concern to writers. Now, this book, The Other, which offers a real critique of our way of life and which asked readers to think about what it means to be a modern person living in the modern world, I could have written that before 9/11, but I didn't, and therefore I think it reads differently.
You're listening to an interview with David Gooderson, whose latest novel is The Other. We can go back to, say, Our Lady of the Forest and this novel in terms of the way people have to look at spirituality and religion, and the way religion not merely played a role in 9/11, obviously it did, but in the way simultaneously religion had taken over politics for a time. And now we're seeing a pushback, I think.
Yes. Now, I think it's generally as a sort of global phenomenon, the idea that in this day and age that fundamentalism can have such a pronounced influence on global affairs, it's a striking truth that this is a pervasive thing. And it's not only pervasive in the Muslim world, but it's also pervasive here. And as you say, in at least the last two elections, the evangelical vote has made a huge, huge difference. This is a powerful force in the life of human beings, no matter what modernity brings. This fundamental approach to spirituality remains powerful.
The Other also deals with people thinking about life in the 70s. I mean, very much a 70s book, which is all pre-fundamentalism, pre-9/11. I wonder if this is, you know, we're both boomers here, if this is a reaction on your part, looking back and going, well, wait a second, there was life before fundamentalism.
You know, looking back, I was 18 in 1974, just a bit too young to really participate in the culture of the 60s, but not so young that I wasn't aware of it or that didn't have a formative influence on my view of life and of the world. And the critique of mainstream society that was generated by the 60s has been powerful for me. That was there prior to 9/11, but after 9/11, that question, why do they hate us, relates right back to those questions that were raised in the 60s and 70s about what is America.
And these last two books also deal with the nature of class.
Yes, this book in particular, The Other, I've read one review that associates it with The Prince and the Pauper. And you've got this very blue-collar kid from very modest circumstances who befriends a very wealthy kid who is the only child of two parents who both bring enormous fortunes to their marriage and therefore make him the sole heir to a vast amount of money. And he's acutely aware that that wealth was accumulated via exploitation of the earth and exploitation of other human beings. And he feels so guilt-ridden about that and so compromised by it that that money is tainted that he doesn't want to have anything to do with it.
And, of course, the irony is that he has no problem using the money in various ways, his own ways, but he uses it.
The irony is that it's impossible for him to really live the pure life that he wants to live. He is a hypocrite. He is compromised. There's no way to entirely escape. We are all dependent on the larger social structure, the larger economic. There's no separating yourself from it. He knows that he lives a compromised life, but he also feels trapped by Jehovah, ultimately.
The book alternates these stories, with long passages involving living in the woods, traveling in the woods, hiking in the woods. Particularly in the Ho Valley. Is there a secret hot springs that you discovered that you haven't told anybody about?
Well, there are two well-known hot springs in the Olympics that people visit, Solduck and Olympic Hot Springs. There is a third that's a bit apocryphal, supposedly it's there, that I've never visited. There is no fourth that I know of in the Valley of the Ho. There really isn't. I'd be surprised if there was. But I have noticed hiking in the winter into hot springs, what a great thing it is and what a lifesaver it is to have it, because you jump into one of those when you've been traveling through snow, and it can literally keep you alive. So if you're going to try to live in the woods, it would be nice to have a hot springs nearby.
Did you have to do any extra research for this book in terms of living in the woods, or was this material that you already knew as a hiker?
The one thing I did, I had heard about a guy who, in fact, did live in the woods for 7 years in the Cascades, east northeast of Seattle. He had survived partly by, in moments of desperation, coming out of the woods, breaking into cabins, and getting what he needed. And I interviewed a tracker and two law enforcement officers who ultimately brought him in from the woods, and they charged him with these break and enters, put him away. And I learned from these three a lot about how he had survived during that time. But other than that, I didn't do any formal research or interviews.
The relationship between Neil Countryman and John William Barry results in a blood pact. And over the course of the next few years, as John William stays in the woods, Neil aids, abets, and enables him to do so, which brings up the morality of what he did. What's your own view about that?
Well, Neil is certainly conflicted throughout his adult life about the tension between honoring this blood pact he has with John William, which says, don't ever tell anybody about this place, don't ever tell anybody where I am, and his recognition that surely John William's parents in particular must really be suffering from the mystery of what happened to their son. As he gets older and becomes a father himself and has his own children, he begins to relate more and more powerfully to what John William's parents must be going through and how much pain must be attached to a missing child, an absent child, and thinks all the time about picking up the phone and telling them. And yet every time he gets close, he's drawn back to that sense of an adolescent blood pact and this sense of obligation to see through a promise that he made. Where do I stand in relationship to that? Really in the same place as Neil, completely conflicted about it, able to see both sides and sort of paralyzed about what to do.
His wife, Jamie, seems to know pretty much the whole story, too, and she's part of this, though we never discover what her feelings are or what her influence is.
Early on, as John William acknowledges that Neil has this other person in his life, he's the one who decides that Jamie should be aware of it, should know about it. And Jamie's ultimate perspective is, I think you should say something about this, but it's not my decision. I can't take this into my own hands.
But, of course, she could.
She could.
I mean, by her saying it's your decision, she's absolving herself of her responsibility and complicity in his death.
Possibly. Or she may be making the decision, and I think she is making the decision, that ultimately she agrees that John William has a right to this. He has a right to live in the woods undisturbed. He has the right to disappear. And that she has no obligation to come forward with information. That's her perspective and Neil's.
How did your wife view the book?
My wife at this point, six books into the process, has learned to see that obviously each book is going to reveal something about me, but it's always something she already knows. In a book, you make yourself sort of naked to the world, but, you know, you've already been naked in front of your spouse forever. So
right.
She reads them with the most sort of detached objectivity she can bring just to tell me if she thinks the book is good or not. But as far as reading them as evidence of my inner life, I don't think she learns a thing from them.
How do you shut off that censor that might say, you know, this is something I don't want to reveal?
You have to be very forthcoming and direct with the people in your life and tell them, look, I write fiction, but all fiction writers derive their material from their texture of their own lives. That is going to include you as my wife or my child or my father or my brother, my mother or my sister. There may be some pain in that for you, but ultimately in the service of the novel and therefore in the service of the reader, people who are reading it, we have to let go of this concern about our individual needs and realize that in the end it doesn't have anything to do with our relationship. It really doesn't. What matters is what happens between us, not what happens on those pages.
David Goodison, there's one other element in the book which relates back to your own life, which is that Neil becomes very wealthy very quickly and also very famous very quickly, which is what happened to you with Snow Falling on Cedars.
It did, and at a relatively young age. Look, prior to that happening to me, I did not believe that wealth and fame had anything to do with happiness, and I still don't believe they have anything to do with happiness. I do know that having money has made it possible for me to write more, that I'm not going to my job as a high school English teacher, and I'm very grateful for that. I'm not dismissing money. Money does make possible the life that you want to have. But money per se and fame per se, I know it's been my own experience, have absolutely nothing to do with happiness.
Yet at the same time, it is nice getting recognized in a restaurant and moving to the front of the line.
Well, I would say it's not nice getting recognized in a restaurant. It makes it feel awkward. You don't feel comfortable. You can't relax. You know, your sense of privacy is a little bit compromised. The idea that you can just move around in the world without that element, I actually feel no attraction to whatever modest celebrity I have. I really don't. I do feel attracted to enough money to give me time to write.
But it also creates the problem when a first novel is as successful financially and critically as Snow Falling on Cedars. It does create the problem of what to do next, where to go next, and how to dissociate yourself from the fact that the odds are good you won't be writing another Snow Falling on Cedars.
Right, and so you really have to not care. I mean, you have to say to yourself that whatever happened with Snow Falling on Cedars, as far as everything post-publication, the awards, the sales, the acclaim, and all that sort of thing, whatever happened has nothing to do with the actual writing of a book. And the years and years that you spend just sitting in one place by yourself writing is its own reward, no matter what happens when the next book and the one after that is published. I mean, I just feel very, very fortunate that I'm able to write a book like the other at this point. And there's no expectation that it will sell as many copies as Snow Falling. There will never be another Snow Falling on Cedars. I don't expect it, and nobody else does. But I'm happy to have the opportunity to continue writing books no matter what happens with them.
Snow Falling on Cedars became a film. How has Hollywood dealt with East of the Mountains, Our Lady, or this one? Have they been optioned?
For a long time, there was no interest in East of the Mountains. Recently, the book has been optioned. Who knows what will happen with it? Our Lady of the Forest was fairly quickly optioned and had some prominent people attached to it. Since then, the director who was originally attached to it has departed. You still have a great screenplay by Connor McPherson, who's become a very well-known playwright on the stage in London and now in New York. The Seafarer is getting a lot of...
Shining City, yeah.
Yeah, this guy has written a beautiful screenplay for Our Lady of the Forest, and I think ultimately a film will get made, probably because it's got a Connor McPherson script.
And do you think The Other could become a film?
It could with time. I think right now, you know, what happens in Hollywood is that some very young people write treatments, a page or so, and hand them to potential directors or producers. And, you know, I'm suspecting that these treatments dismiss the book as we've already seen this. It's called Into the Wild. This is just a repeat. When, in fact, it's a completely different book, a completely different story. And I'm hoping that some director or producer will get past the treatment, actually look at the book, and think about the possibilities.
David Gooderson, many writers talk about writer's block, and some people have it, and some people say that it's impossible. You said that after 9/11 you had it for a while.
Yeah, it was sort of an easy way to just, you know, easy term to sort of summarize what was happening to me, which is that I felt like turning towards nonfiction. There was something about living in the dream of the novel, escaping into the dream every day, that was literally impossible. I mean, the world had really asserted itself and inserted itself into our lives. And that sense of the freedom and the comfort to be able to get up in the morning and go live in a dream all day, it was just impossible. The real world had really been brought to bear on our lives and on my life. And I started thinking in terms of the essay, journalism, and of responding. The interesting thing was that even though I was thinking in those terms, nothing was coming. None of that sort of thing actually got written.
Even the nonfiction.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about it, and it was paralyzing my fiction. But I realized after a while, you know, I'm thinking about writing nonfiction in response to how the world is now, but I'm not doing it. Why is that? Because I really am a fiction writer. I need to get back to it. It just took a while for that to...
Was there a specific breakthrough?
I think like most Americans, it just took a certain amount of time. You know, there was nothing dramatic that happened, but over time we accommodated this new reality, we adjusted, and we went on with our lives, and that's what happened to me.
In 1992, you wrote a book about homeschooling, even though you were a high school teacher at the time. I guess the idea of homeschooling, you know, the two sides of it, one is the parents need to be on top of it, and the last thing you want is their propaganda to infiltrate. And then, of course, we could also talk about socialization and everything. On the other hand, since you've written the book, we have No Child Left Behind, which, as one writer, I forgot who it was, said about it, it's turning every student into an employee. All they're doing is taking tests.
Yeah. Well, my book on homeschooling, as you mentioned, came out in 92, is not an advocacy book. I sought to answer the questions that were out there in the world about homeschooling. For example, the socialization question, the should it be legal question, what has the Supreme Court had to say about it, how does it work academically, what is the history behind this, what is the anthropology behind this, does it make any sense, you know, is it anti-American, what is it? I wasn't trying to give answers so much as present these questions for people to reflect on. And I do believe that for all of the negatives that can attach to homeschooling, there are also positives. The same thing can be said of institutionalized schooling. Whenever I hear somebody say, oh, homeschool kids don't get a good education, they only get propaganda from their parents, I think of all the kids who are utterly failed by institutionalized education, the masses and masses of kids who don't get a good education for reasons inherent to an institution. And so any form of education is going to have its negatives and positives, its pros and cons, and homeschooling does too.
Yeah, well, I look at that and I think of the education I got in New York City, which was quite good and quite extensive way back when. And I compare it to, you know, my own knowledge in my 20s or teens, compare it to the knowledge of kids in their 20s and teens and now. And I'm fairly appalled by what's happened to the institution of the public school.
Well, the institution of the public school is suffering partly because of political ineptitude, but it's also not so much a cause as a symptom of something larger going on in the culture. I think that these institutions are at war with a general anti-intellectual strain in our culture. I think a lot of kids now dismiss what happens at school as secondary to some other view of the world, and schools no longer have the power to shape lives that they once had.
I also think they don't teach thinking like they used to, but maybe that's just me. I don't know.
I think that's going to vary from school to school quite a bit. And, you know, I know from having taught public high school for 10 years that it really, I believe this strongly, what it comes down to is who's teaching and what happens when you shut that door. And it's going to come down to that individual and how they feel about what they're doing. And that is probably the most important factor in education. I think we should be paying teachers enough that we attract good people. There are a lot of smart people in this country who don't go into teaching because they can't make a good living at it. And that, I think, is sad.
David Gooderson, now you've come out with The Other, have you begun thinking about your next book?
I have begun thinking about a next book, another novel. And I find myself interested in the notion of blindness, not physical blindness, but how it's possible for somebody to be entirely blind to themselves and not to see themselves clearly. And if you see that in somebody else and you see that that's possible, then isn't it possible in you? And once you become aware of that, you realize that you don't know yourself. And maybe you can't know yourself. Maybe you are blind to yourself. And I'm interested in pursuing that in fictional form.
I could see that as kind of this weird sort of mystery.
Yeah, you know, again, this is very formative. I don't know what shape it's going to take, but right. I know I'm interested in the idea, and it could have an element of mystery.
Do you plan to go back to class or race?
Not right now, no. Right. It's not something that's sort of in me right now to write about. It's impossible for me to look into the future and say where my writing will go. I draw a blank after every book for a while, and it takes me a while to figure out what to do next. Some authors will say, well, I have three or four ideas lined up, and I'm not one of those. It's one at a time for me.
You've been listening to an interview with David Gooderson, whose latest novel is The Other. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.